Good morning. This is Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl. Earl Ingram is normally here. It's his voice that normally comes on after the song, but today it's mine. And, you know, today, Calvin. First of all, Calvin, how do people call into this show?
The call-in number is 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789.
So I woke up this morning, Calvin, on pins and needles because this is going to be a really big day, apparently. You know what's going to happen today?
What is that?
Aaron Rodgers apparently might actually say what he's going to do. You know, he enjoys keeping the world on pins and needles. Little does he know that as each day goes by, the world cares less and less about what this outcome is going to be. You care so little that you don't even know why today's a big day. He's apparently appearing on that the show that he goes on every week on Wednesdays, and they're announcing he's coming on live. It's a big day, and you know, actually, he doesn't understand that people don't really give a flying. He's done this so long and so often. That it's almost like waking up and waiting to see what Trump has said next, except with Aaron, it's waking up to see what he doesn't say. You know, he sends out mysterious tweets, you know, designed to pique everyone's interest. What is Aaron going to do? And what he's actually done, I think, is back himself into a corner where all it is deja vu, you know. It's just like, okay, another day with Aaron Rodgers being the center or trying to be the center of attention for NFL football. And the only problem is that everyone seems to give him that kind of attention. It's the Trump deal. You know, everyone gave Trump attention because he said something every day. And apparently everyone's willing to give Aaron Rodgers attention every day because he doesn't say anything. He just tweets mysteriously. So what do you think he's going to do, Calvin? Do you fall in the category of people who could care less?
I care. I follow the NFL pretty closely. I'm pretty certain he's going to the Jets.
Yeah, well, the Jets. God bless the Jets then, because I think what he's proving himself to be is less than a perfect teammate, you know? And apparently he's got an entourage he wants with him. Alan Lazard has already gone to the Jets, right? So that's...
That's part of the reason why I'm pretty certain it's the Jets.
Seemed like a big hint. That was a tell, as I think they say in the gambling game. Yeah, but deja vu, you know, things that keep happening over and over. That's what, deja vu is where you think it's happened already, right? It's like, oh my God. Deja vu. I feel like this has already happened. And with Aaron Rodgers, like this has already happened, right? Last year, now this year. And deja vu, he goes to the Jets. I think there was another quarterback for the Packers who did pretty much the same thing, right?
Yeah, I think there was.
Yeah. And how did that work out for him? He didn't get to the Super Bowl, I know that.
Certainly not with the Jets. He got close with the Vikings.
Close to the Vikings, that's right. Well, maybe that'll be the path. Maybe Aaron's next stop, first the Jets, next the Vikings. But speaking of deja vu, you know, I was thinking about this whole bank failure thing, and we've got Congress calling for hearings to investigate the bank regulations and regulators and to investigate the bankers themselves and figure out what went wrong. But somehow this is deja vu. Every time something goes wrong, we've got bipartisan congressional investigations to investigate what the hell happened, you know? And I can think of a whole string of these kind of things. I remember the hurricanes down in New Orleans, the disasters they had there. What were they investigating then? Was it FEMA, Calvin? I think it was, right?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And then we had the Boeing aircraft and the Boeing had failed to come out with, you know, their planes were sold, several of them crashed, they realized they were unsafe, and then who were they investigating? I think they were investigating Boeing, but there was an agency too, wasn't it? Was it the FAA?
Yes, sounds right.
Yeah, they investigated the FAA. The FAA wasn't doing its job in regulating Boeing, and it turned out maybe they weren't, because the FAA had turned over to Boeing a bunch of testing that was that should have or could have been done by the FAA independently, but they said, no, Boeing, you can do this yourself. Just report the results to us. We'll trust you. And it was those very tests which could have uncovered the problems with the jets that, that were then caused several fatal accidents and cost Boeing a lot of money. You know, they had to delay the manufacturing and sale of the aircraft. It was the Dreamliner, I believe. And so that was a big problem. And then somehow I think during the Affordable Care Act, they were worried about elements of it, investigations of it. The only thing that they ended up modifying in the legislature was they rolled back a tax on medical equipment, bipartisan vote to roll back a tax on medical equipment. Otherwise, Affordable Care Act was off limits. Well, that rollback certainly must have been done at the behest of the medical equipment manufacturers. Pandemic. Did the pandemic uncover any problems with the government? I think it did, didn't it? I mean, aren't they now, even now, investigating the CDC, trying to figure out whether it did its job?
Yes, there were certainly conflicting things that were coming out. There was whether the response was quick enough. There was definitely things that are being investigated.
Well, and I think they investigated as well the ability to hand out the billions of dollars of money that the government authorized to be sent out to the people, and the government couldn't get its act together to get that accomplished, as I recall. I think that's right. And so then we had to investigate the competence of the government, even to the point of was the government competent to distribute a whole bunch of subsidy supplement money that was to be sent out to the people. And then, of course, it's a long list, you know. Every time something happens in our economy that's startling, that we end up with a congressional investigation to see why government didn't accomplish its purpose, and all the time that they aren't carrying out those investigations, it seems like, and in fact I think it factually is the fact that on a bipartisan basis, our government has been effectively responding to the demands of K Street by rolling back regulations. Because when you get down to almost every one of these kinds of investigations that's ongoing, including the current one with respect to the bank failures that happened last weekend, we find out that on a bipartisan basis, our legislature in Washington, responding to the calls from the lobbyists, has rolled back regulations. And that rollback of regulations ends up biting both the public and the industry that has that was out there in Washington lobbying to have less restraints imposed on it by government. And then they find out when those restraints are lifted, it bites them in the tail, and they end up, like, for instance, Boeing, I'm sure, was leaning on the FAA both directly and through its lobbyists. I think Boeing has more lobbyists in Washington than any other corporation. And they were leaning on Washington to let up on the FAA strict regulation, get it trust us, Boeing was saying. I'm sure we can take care of this. Sure, they took care of it. And when they didn't take care of it adequately, and when the FAA was operating less diligently, it nearly cost Boeing its entire commercial aviation business. It almost needed a federal supplementation of a bailout. So, you know, that industry bit off its nose despite its face. And that's not the only industry that can tell that story. We look at FEMA. We need FEMA. Everyone needs FEMA. Republicans need FEMA. Democrats need FEMA. But do we fund FEMA adequately? Doesn't look like it. Every time we have a disaster, we call FEMA on the carpet to find out whether or not the government's able to respond to the disaster. And so I guess I would lay all of this at the feet of what Tom from California always calls in about, which is money and politics. Because there's no question that lobbying is the result of money and politics. And lobbying as an industry has gone from scant few in the 50s and 60s to one of the biggest industries in Washington right now. You talk about service industries. This is a big service industry, and lobbying is a very profitable service industry. And lobbying, it used to be that Mitch McConnell and the people who were running the government were and LBJ back in his day, government was the entity that could dispense benefits out there to the public, and people were coming to the government and trying to do its favor in order to get what they could get in exchange, which would be things like military bases and other kinds of value. Now it's the other way around. Industry's calling the dance. Industry's actually telling government what they want, and then they get it. Big pharma, you know, one of the biggest scandals, I think, ongoing is the fact that big pharma has persuaded a bipartisan legislature, a bipartisan Congress, to restrict the ability of the federal government to negotiate for prescription prices. And, you know, that's contributing mightily to the immense cost of health care in the United States. The whole broken health care system, the fact that the health care insurance industry called the dance for affordable health care. You know, the Affordable Health Care Act could have been Medicare for all, but for the fact that the health care insurance industry got in the way of that, made sure it was impossible to even consider that, and required the Obama Act to basically be a private insurance act modeled after what was put forth in Massachusetts, I think at the behest of the Heritage Foundation. So we're going to explore today some things. We're going to explore the current bank failure and look at it through the eyes of the failed regulation process, but the failed regulation process that was created by the bipartisan acts of Congress dancing the dance of K Street. We're also going to talk about the healthcare industry. Starting at 9, I've got a fellow calling in, John Hopkins, who's working on a business model that tries to respond to our totally broken healthcare system. So we'll be back shortly after this break. But I think we have some interesting things to talk about today, all of them tied together with the money and politics issue. Hi, Sandy Williams sitting in this morning for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show. This morning we're talking about the horror of bipartisan conduct. I guess I would say a theme here this morning is going to be, hey, if the Congress accomplishes it on a bipartisan basis, look out, you know, because it's almost impossible for Congress to do anything where it's bipartisan unless K Street has lined them up carefully, got them all their ducks in a row to, for instance, push forward on deregulation and deregulating things and we can talk about a number of them where deregulation just maybe hasn't turned out that well. Or the war against government. You know, this is probably less than bipartisan, but the effort to strangle government of its money and to make it less able to function ends up creating a situation where we have many failures. And surely K Street has played a big role in causing regulation to recede to the point and to cripple government to the point where it apparently can't do its job when it needs to. Before the break, we were going through a list of it, but, you know, the list is long. We didn't even mention all of them. I can remember just a couple of years ago, and maybe it's ongoing still, the FDA and baby food. We had baby formula going out with, you know, that was actually killing children. It was unsafe and was determined that there was probably a regulatory failure on the part of the FDA in that process and maybe a regulatory failure on the part of the government in terms of how it was carrying out the process of buying up such food. We had the CDC failure in the pandemic. We have the bank failure ongoing. Gosh, just last month we had the train failure. We have ongoing investigations in train regulation. When things fail, all of a sudden we have to call both the the management of the businesses that might be involved on the carpet. It's your fault. And we have to call in the government folks who should have stopped it, right, and say, no, it's your fault. And incidentally, however, Congress never seems to turn the finger back on itself and say, gosh, maybe what we did contributed mightily to these problems. Maybe what Congress did, crippling the funding of and the reputation of government agencies like FEMA, had a lot to do with FEMA's failure in New Orleans back during the Bush administration. Maybe what's happened in terms of antitrust regulation and the failure or the lack thereof has a lot to do with the fact that we've crippled the reputation of government, and no longer do the best and brightest young lawyers want to go to work for the Justice Department to work in the antitrust division. No, they all want to go to work for private industry. And if they're lucky, maybe they'll get a good job on K Street where they can make a fortune as a lobbyist. I think the one theme this morning is, like, if Congress is able to do something on a bipartisan basis, look out. Because they probably have, in some fashion, have their hand in your pocket, or at least Congress has had their hand in their pocket, the lobbyist pocket, and they've carried out things that are being enacted, or things that are happening in our regulatory process that are not necessarily in the public interest, but are definitely in the interest of private interest groups in the country who have their finger on the political process. They have a great deal of sway in who gets elected and who doesn't get elected. And now, instead of the parties calling the shots, and instead of the government being able to essentially hand out largesse, it's the lobbyists who hand out largesse to the politicians in Washington. And it's the politicians who are dancing a dance not called by Washington, but called by the moneyed interests in Washington. And I guess to roll this back into focus, I guess we could talk about the most recent failure. We could spend some time talking about the rail failure and the failure of the regulation on rails and the horrible problem of derailments happening apparently at a rapid clip in Pennsylvania, but elsewhere, and the danger to the public that poses. But an even broader danger is the danger to our financial system, because yes, a bank fails and the shareholders in that bank suffer and the depositors in that bank suffer, but it's not an isolated circumstance. As we can see from Silicon Valley Bank, which by its name suggests that it's a regional bank servicing the needs of this place that we all know about and haven't been to called Silicon Valley. But the fact is that when the financial markets fail, it hurts all of us, because a meltdown of our financial market, as we found out in 2008, can take our houses away, can take our jobs away, it can cripple our entire economy, it can make all of us suffer, and the question is, could it have been avoided, should it have been avoided? And I will tell you that when we start unbundling bank regulation and what's going on and what has gone on with bank regulation, I think we can see that we can lay a lot of these problems at the feet not only of regulation of the banks and the operation of the banks by the operators, but we ultimately can lay this at the feet of the legislature, and we can lay it at the feet of the bipartisan legislatures Congress, the bipartisan Congress at the time of Clinton, for instance, that rolled back the Glass-Steagall Act. You know, I think many of us on the listening now are too young to even remember what the Glass-Steagall Act was about. But the Glass-Steagall Act was created during the Depression to make sure that banks would be safe and that banks would do what banks were basically the business model for commercial banks. And after the break, we'll talk a bit about this. I hope we've got some callers who want to dip their oar in the water about the rollback of regulation and the problems associated with money. But I'd like to talk a bit more after the break about how we got to where we got to with banking and how much it's the fault of K Street and lobbying, and how much industry, particularly banking industry, has bitten their nose off despite their face by accomplishing what they want in their own deregulation. We'll be back shortly. Good morning, Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show. Calvin, since bright, shiny morning this morning, how do people who have gotten themselves up at this point call into the show if they want to?
The number is 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789.
Yeah, this morning, at least for a while, I want to talk about how it is that our government has run amok at the behest of the industry that is regulated by the government, that has prompted the government to take its foot off the gas and to put a lighter hand on the industry that's being regulated. And the one that we look at, you know, it goes week to week. We're still looking at the railroad industry and the level to which it's regulated. And the Congress that investigates that regulation doesn't talk about the extent to which it was complicit in causing the regulation to be less rigorous on the railroads, and that less rigorous regulation which has then resulted in these accidents. No, Congress tends to want to point the finger at, one, the regulators who are sitting in offices in Washington, and two, the business people who are running the businesses, and yet an awful lot of what happens in this regard is the result of K Street's impact on Congress itself and on Washington and its regulations. And so this week's failure of regulation relates to the banking industry. But it goes far deeper than this last week and what happened to Silicon Valley and Signature Bank and Silvergate Bank, these three banks that went belly up during this last sort of mini catastrophe. And it wasn't really a catastrophe. It wasn't a catastrophe until a bank failed. And then it kind of felt like a potentially financial contagion. And the bank failure is the question is, you know, is there something wrong in the banking industry that allows one bank failure to feel like a contagion? And I think that which is wrong is the fact that there's a doubt about whether banks are adequately regulated or whether banks themselves are exposing themselves to risks which put banks at greater risk than they ought to be experiencing. And so all of this can kind of be traced back to the 1990s under Bill Clinton. The Bill Clinton White House, in conjunction with the bipartisan Congress, decided to re-examine, and this was at the behest basically of the big banks and the investment banking industry, they decided to re-examine whether the country really needed what was called the Glass-Steagall Act, the restrictions imposed by the Glass-Steagall Act. And the Glass-Steagall Act was kind of a well-known kind of a limitation. It was voted out in the 90s, so many people today might not remember what it was. But the Glass-Steagall Act was enacted during the Great Depression of the 30s, and it was designed to restrict the activities of banks so that the banks themselves could not invest on their own account in risky investments. A bank could not invest in the commodity market for itself. The bank could not take its assets and invest in risky asset-backed treasury or asset-backed bond instruments. It was basically restricted to carrying out the business model for a commercial bank, and this was all done in exchange for setting up Federal Deposit Insurance. So the FDIC Corporation was set up. It guaranteed the deposits of money from depositors, and so it was very comfortable for banks to be able to go out, and very easy for them to go out and gather deposits from people because their deposits were guaranteed. In exchange for that guarantee, the banks agreed that they would not put themselves at substantial risk of failure by investing their deposits in anything but loans, okay? The commercial loans or retail loans, the kind of things that banks are expert at doing, banks understand the risk of, banks are able to build up a portfolio of loans that creates some diversity in their portfolio that minimizes their risk. But no, during the 90s, the investment bankers and the banks said, you know what, that pretty much ties up our hands. We'd like to get into some much more profitable fields of endeavor. We'd like to be able to invest in the commodity market. We'd like to be able to invest in massive kinds of more speculative investments that would improve our bottom line. And incidentally, you can trust us. We're smart. And you know, we are regulated. So, you know, you'll be able to catch us if we're making terrible mistakes. And so, yep, they lifted the Glass-Steagall Act. That was in the 90s. It didn't take more than about 10 or 12 years to 2008 to have the banking industry almost collapse. Why did they collapse? Because the bankers had decided to invest not in loans to their depositors, not in loans to their community, the commercial businesses with which they had experience. No, they had decided to invest in much more risky kinds of instruments. And it was those instruments that failed, okay? The bank created a marketplace for these mortgage-backed securities and these great pools of mortgage-backed securities. And when that market was created by the banks as investors, then the financial market responded by creating these great massive pools. And those pools themselves became, it turned out, very risky. And so the failure of 2008 in the financial market, while people wanted to point at regulators who had failed, and they really wanted to point at bankers who had failed, the bankers were really just playing the new game that had been designed for them with the rescission of the Glass-Steagall Act. The bankers would not have been in a position to do what they did if the Glass-Steagall Act had not been rescinded. So, you know, the failure of 2008 really can be laid to many respects to the feet of the bipartisan Congress that decided to rescind the Glass-Steagall Act in the 1990s, setting the stage for a much riskier banking industry, setting the stage for a banking industry that became highly consolidated by bigger and bigger banks. You know, there was a time in the period in the 1970s and 80s where banks were nowhere near as big, could not have branches outside of the state in which they were operating. And banks were restricted in size for the same reason as the Glass-Steagall Act restricted investments. They were restricted in size so they would focus on what they were good at, making loans to companies that they had familiarity with, making loans to individuals that they were familiar with, controlling their risk, and taking depositors' money, using it for the purpose of essentially benefiting the community. So, you know, we've had failures after failures of our government processes. And we've had a Congress which hypocritically wants to point at regulators and the business people when very frequently the problem lies right there in Congress, right there down the street on K Street. And it's a reflection of what is failing in American government, which is a government which is responsive to special interests. And how did this hurt the public? Well, the most recent rescission in response to the 2008 bank failure and the financial market failures, we had the Dodd-Frank Act enacted. And Dodd-Frank required that one of the things it required was that banks larger than $50 billion carry out very extensive periodic biennial stress testing to test whether the bank was capitalized in a manner and was making investments of its money in a manner which could withstand various kinds of scenarios in the economy. Could it withstand a rise in interest rates? And they would force the bank to go through a scenario run of interest rates going up at a material level. And what did that do to the safety of the bank? And the Dodd-Frank restrictions were working. Banks were actually being forced to pull in their horns, to behave in a more conservative manner, in a more careful manner, a manner which was much less likely to fail. Now, a bunch of banks decided this was inconvenient and expensive and kind of tied their hands in a manner that they didn't really appreciate. So what we call regional banks, banks that denominated themselves essentially as banks smaller than $250 billion in assets, banded together, went to Washington, and persuaded the Congress that they ought to rescind the Dodd-Frank stress test kinds of restrictions on banks for banks smaller than $250 billion in assets. What kind of banks are smaller than $250 billion in assets? Well, Silicon Valley Bank. And in fact, the CEO of the Silicon Valley Bank appeared before Congress at the time of the Dodd-Frank the hearings regarding the revision to the Dodd-Frank restrictions. Mr. Berger appeared before Congress to argue on behalf of rescinding these restrictions because regional banks were too small. A failure of a regional bank wouldn't be a big national matter anyway. They shouldn't be imposing these kinds of difficult restraints on regional banks. And lo and behold, K Street prevailed. And banks, the restriction was reduced so that, and President Trump signed it with a lot of ballyhoo saying that he was liberating banks from having their hands tied behind their backs in such a manner, liberating banks that were larger than $50 billion and smaller than $250 billion. All of these were liberated from these restrictions. Well, guess what? All of the banks that failed over this past weekend fall within that $50 to $250 billion range. All of the banks which failed ended up losing money for their investors, for their bondholders, and putting the nation's banking system at such risk that the banking system had to respond by revising the FDIC guarantee in a major way. So now, under the revised and temporary FDIC restrictions, all deposits are guaranteed. All deposits, whether they be $250,000 or less or $15 million or more, every deposit is now going to be guaranteed in the near term, at least, during this emergency condition. An emergency condition which was created by the failure of three banks who fell below this $250 billion number, for which Congress just recently lifted the restraints in terms of the nature of the regulations on it. And so, and incidentally, who is suffering most in the near term from this? Well, it turns out that the government is saving the depositors from suffering because this guarantee is going to cover their bottoms. But the people who are suffering are regional banks. The stock market yesterday fell apart for a number of banks. Which banks suffered the most in terms of the value of their stock? Regional banks. So, as I said before, industry that comes forward to have the regulations on it modified and removed ends up cutting off their nose to spite their face. Because you know what? Government regulation frequently helps the very industry that's being regulated. It helps the very industry that's being inconvenienced by the regulations. It helps the very industries that are being constrained and saved essentially from themselves. The Dodd-Frank kinds of stress testing was designed to save banks from themselves. It was designed to save them from a profit motive, which would prompt them to put their money into kinds of investments which were too strict, which were too risky, and would put the bank at risk. With the new FDIC kinds of guarantees, who's most at risk when a bank is too risky in its investments? The bank itself. So, you know, the banks were too smart. They were too smart by one half. They didn't want to be constrained and inconvenienced by regulations. The loss of those regulations has caused not only the three banks who went out of business to have their owners lose all of their money with respect to their money in the bank, but they've caused a whole sector of banking, which is essentially this regional bank sector, banks smaller than $250 billion, to be put at great risk. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to find now that the next movement in the banking industry will be the consolidation of regional banks into major banks. And incidentally, major banks aren't very good for the country. Not many people in this country go and get their first mortgage loan from a major national bank. They go to local regional banks. So after the break, we'll come back. We'll finish in this last segment a discussion of the banking sector. And we can go to the truly failed sector of our economy, which is the healthcare sector. We'll be back. Good morning. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show. It's Wednesday morning. This is the day, I guess. Aaron Rodgers might actually spill the beans during the podcast that he's going to be on. Who knows? This is every day. You know, I find myself, it's kind of, my guilty pleasure, maybe. Every morning I open my phone to see if I can find the most recent news about Aaron Rodgers. And I know personally, I don't give a damn. You know, I'm sick of it. I'm almost as sick of Aaron Rodgers as I was about reading about Donald Trump day after day after day. But I do it every day. I check. And so maybe today's the day, you know, and when we get all done hearing the news, we'll all ask ourselves, why did we care? But we do. We've been talking this morning about the failure of our government to carry out the regulation that protects not only the people of this country, but the very industries that are being regulated. And the fact that the reason this seems to be happening, in spite of the fact that the Congress wants to conduct hearings to point at either regulators or the corporate executives that are residing in the businesses that end up having these problems, that ultimately a good part of the problem lies at the feet of Congress itself, the Congress that has decided to indulge industry in its deregulation. You know, we had over the years, we had learned that when things happened that were troublesome, we would enact regulations to respond to them, and then our memory would fade, and we would rescind the regulation. So, you know, we had, like I said earlier in the prior section, the Glass-Steagall Act was enacted during the Great Depression, and for about 50 years, even 60 years, the memory of people was such that they remembered why that act was enacted, why it was important, why it was maybe good that banks didn't have an unfettered ability to chase profit, and rather were provided with a pathway towards relatively easy profit making so long as they stayed in their lane and made commercial loans and retail loans that were related to businesses and people with which they had regional familiarity. And we dispensed with that. We got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. We allowed banks to essentially operate like investment banks and make any and all kinds of investments on behalf of the bank, using the proceeds and deposits that were put in the bank by Tom, Dick, and Mary, as well as large corporations, and creating a whole different risk profile for the industry of banking. And we found out how that was a problem in 2008. And I would assert that this is all because Congress, on a bipartisan basis, is giving courtesan treatment to K Street. K Street basically is given access, like the courtesans of old, to the throne. K Street has the keys to the throne. They have the keys to Washington. They have the keys to getting things accomplished. To such a degree that I've come to the point of, I guess, complete cynicism and deciding that when anything happens in Congress that is passed on a bipartisan basis, you can be almost certain that either it is being sponsored by K Street on a broad fashion, number one, or number two, K Street just doesn't care about it at all. And so we've got either of those two options can result in bipartisan conduct. Otherwise, It's gridlock. If K Street doesn't want it and want it badly, it doesn't happen. And if K Street doesn't want it to happen, it doesn't happen, in spite of whatever the public opinion might be. So, you know, we already know that from a public opinion standpoint, more people favor gun controls than don't. But gun controls are a political third rail. We're never going to talk about that. We're never going to talk about it in Congress. If you talk about it, you might not get elected. You'll face at least primary opposition. And there's all kinds of third rails. In the third hour of this segment, I think we'll talk about defense and the extent to which defense is a third rail. And during this next hour, we're going to talk about the healthcare industry. What could be more broken in this country than the healthcare industry? And, you know, when something is as broken as the healthcare industry, and rather than getting fixed, tends to get more and more broke, I think you can basically lay that to the feet of K Street, that there are very strong lobbying interests that make sure that the healthcare industry caters to the needs of various special interests. For instance, Big Pharma can't negotiate the price of pharmaceuticals. The federal government can't. That's a constraint clearly imposed by through the activities of K Street. And so we'll talk about, and you know, the whole principle of cost controls in the healthcare industry are gone, right? We've got the most expensive healthcare industry in the world, and we have really way down the level of, in terms of measuring across the world what kind of health outcomes we have, we don't rank near the top at all. There's plenty of countries in the world who have better health outcomes for its citizenry than our most expensive in the world healthcare system. That seems to me to be the definition of broken. And so, you know, today, bank failures. Every day, healthcare system. Every day, our national foreign policy and defense budget. Every day, we're feeling the effects of a government that seems only to be responsive to special interests in K Street. Every day, we suffer the consequences of having a government which has essentially courtiers. You know, you talk about the old days, in the days of kings and queens. Kings and queens had courtiers. They had people who were favored, who had access to, could come to all the parties that the king and queen had, who would be given and dispensed all the favors that the king or queen had to dispense. They would be given, like Sir Walter Raleigh, control over the tobacco crops in the New World America. That was a dispensed favor. Well, I'm afraid that what we've got today is something that looks and smells a great deal like the favors accorded courtesans. We now have our courtesans, however, reside on K Street, and they're the lobbyists and they're the influence peddlers for the moneyed interests in America. And, you know, I didn't talk like this 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I didn't see so very clearly then how clearly now I can see the effect of money in politics and the extent to which almost every day when something goes wrong, you can track it back to a situation in which K Street has had its way, and it's had its way to the detriment of the effectiveness of government. FEMA, you know, the list is long. FEMA, the FDA, the FAA, the banking regulations, the healthcare regulations, the CDC, you know, everywhere we turn, every time government is called upon to do something, it seems to stub its toe. So we'll be back after the break shortly, and we'll be talking then about healthcare. I've got a fellow, John Hopkins, a friend of mine who's going to call in, who's got an interesting solution potentially to how we can all potentially solve the healthcare problems we face. See you after the break.